This edition of The Recap was first broadcast on the 1st of August 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello, I'm Ben Rylan and welcome to The Recap, bringing you the highlights from the past week's live news and analysis programs broadcast here on Monocle 24. Over the next half hour, we'll bring you some of the very best interviews and reports from The Globalist, The Briefing, Midori House and The Monocle Daily. Coming up, reflections on President Obama's speech at the African Union and thoughts on Ukraine's prospect for EU membership. Plus, we'll hear from our Istanbul bureau chief as Turkey ramps up its role in the fight against Islamic State and Kurdish militants too.
They need to create a buffer zone at the top of Syria that people displaced by the fight by ISIS essentially have somewhere to go that is not just drifting into territory in a manner that this porous border that we've heard about that can't be controlled by the government.
That's in a highlight from Monday's episode of The Briefing. And a little later, we turn our thoughts to Disneyland.
People put out the market what it will bear. I don't care. If people don't want to go to Disney, don't go. Guess what? The price will fall.
All that and much more coming up in the next half hour right here on The Recap with me, Ben Rylan. We start the program by turning to Turkey. On Monday, headlines focused on that country's actions and their consequences as it ramped up its role in the fight against not only Islamic State, but Kurdish militants too. The turnaround came after a suspected IS suicide bombing that killed 32 people earlier this month in the town of Suruç, close to the Syrian border. On Monday's episode of The Briefing, there were plenty of topics up for discussion. Turkey's pursuit of the PKK, its increased involvement in the fight against IS, and plans for a NATO meeting. Mark Asipi presented the program and caught up with our Istanbul bureau chief, Christopher Lord, to discuss the latest.
Over the weekend, we've had some extremely enormous events happen. First of all, there were some peace marches planned for yesterday in Istanbul, which were essentially anti-ISIS marches, pushing for peace and so on, as Turkey's now involving itself in two separate wars, one against ISIS and one against the PKK. These peace marches were banned unilaterally by the government and by the municipality in Istanbul, saying that their reason being that it would cause too much of a traffic problem. What happened, however, Marcus, was that these splinter groups did arrive and they did march, and that then turned into violence with one policeman dead out of this. So as we woke up this morning, we faced with this news, as you say, this extraordinary news now from the New York Times, which we broke the story this morning, that Turkey and the US are going to begin clearing ISIS from a strip of the north of Syria, right on the borderland between Turkey and Syria. So this is an extraordinary moment of cooperation between these two countries that really, I think, from Turkey's perspective, what they're trying to do is stem that growing refugee crisis. They need to create a buffer zone at the top of Syria that people displaced by the fight by ISIS essentially have somewhere to go that is not just drifting into territory in a manner that this porous border that we've heard about that can't be controlled by the government.
Chris, what is the feeling in Turkey now in regards who's the greater threat to the country? Is it PKK or Islamic State?
Well, I think in terms of the threat, that's what somebody's still trying to work out. I mean, for a start, you know, this bomb that went off last week in Suruç was extremely traumatic for people here. I mean, not only the fact that these were young people essentially, you know, going to do some humanitarian efforts in Kobani. These are very, you know, young people with good intentions of what they would, why they were heading south over the border. So that has been extremely traumatic here. I think what's even more traumatic, though, beyond whether, you know, which of these fights is more prominent in people's minds, I think what's very traumatic for people here is Turkey has gone from being essentially, to some extent, aloof from the situation in Syria, in the sense that, you know, trying to maintain a little bit of neutrality in the whole thing, or at least staying back from the fight, not joining that US-led coalition when it was first put on the table. But what's happened now is suddenly Turkey's in war with at war with two different parties. And so there's a story, there's an editorial by Nuray Mert, who's one of the lead writers there at Hurriyet, and she's, you know, her headline is Turkey's grand offensive against all. And I think that's a certain feeling here in Turkey. I was speaking to somebody this morning again as well, who feels as if, you know, again, Turkey is somehow at the beck and call of the US. You know, again, it's back on this cooperation with the US that some people actually feel uncomfortable with. You know, Turkey's being dragged into a war, some people feel, that the people don't want. So, you know, we have to remember always, whenever we look at any foreign policy issue with Turkey, the line has been, for the government, for so long, zero problems with neighbours, which means that it's an aloof foreign policy. And so, therefore, when it does engage in any form of conflict like this, it's extremely traumatic for the people because they don't know what kind of worms that's going to open.
Christopher Lord there, our bureau chief in Istanbul, talking to Marcus Hippie on Monday's episode of The Briefing. You're listening to The Recap on Monocle 24. Time to turn to Ukraine. Last year, it signed a broad political and trade accord with the European Union, turning its back on Russia and looking to the West. It was a victory for pro-EU Ukrainians, who drove Russian-backed President Yanukovych from power after he abandoned the pact last year in return for financial help from Moscow. New President Petro Poroshenko hoped the accord would ensure his country was now firmly bound to Europe. But while the president remains outwardly supportive of closer EU ties, it remains a contentious issue. Observers outside Ukraine generally agree that EU membership is a long way off. But the nation's foreign minister says if Ukraine doesn't become a member within 5 years, it never will. On Tuesday on The Globalist, Georgina Godwin heard the view of Mary Dejevsky from The Independent here in the UK.
I think one of the things that he may have at the back of his mind is Turkey, where there was sort of huge enthusiasm at the beginning generated by members of the European Union, which has then sort of faded and everything sort of stalled. And now it almost looks further and further away. And I think he may be afraid that momentum is being lost. But I think you could also argue that the momentum was, to an extent, a figment of the Ukrainian imagination.
Mm. He says that he fears the EU itself will have undergone major changes. Is he right? And if so, how do you think that the union would have altered?
Well, I think that the problem is actually the union has already altered. The immediate cause of that is Greece. I mean, the European Union is simply not about to take in any country which is going to look like a potential Greece. And Ukraine actually looks worse than that. So I think that's the immediate reason. But if you go back, I think that the attitudes in European Union, there was a huge enthusiasm for expansion towards the east. And Ukraine could arguably say that it's almost been a victim of that, that it came a bit late. And I think there is simply no appetite in the European Union for going any further east.
And that's borne out by the visa policy, isn't it? Because it seems that, I mean, although Ukraine may want to be part of Europe, as you say, Europe doesn't necessarily want Ukraine to join. It's been reported, I think, that 16 of 22 EU countries have increased visa barriers for Ukrainians. So they're unlikely to welcome the country as a full member if they don't even want to allow its citizens to visit.
Well, I think Ukraine has a justified grievance here because it unilaterally abandoned making visas mandatory for EU citizens as a sort of, it was a gesture around the time of the European Cup and when Ukraine won the Eurovision Song Contest. And they did that sort of on the understanding that if they took that measure unilaterally, then there would be reciprocity from the rest of the European Union in time. Mm. Well, actually, that hasn't happened. Mm. And unrest in Ukraine has meant that I think some European countries looked at the prospect of greater migration from Ukraine, which would be illegal migration, and there are a lot of Ukrainians. Ukraine is a big country, and they've moved in the opposite direction.
Ukraine's got every right to be quite cross with the EU then.
Yes, it has, because, you know, it rescinded its visa policy in good faith, hoping for reciprocity, and it hasn't happened.
Mm. Just back to Klimkin, he's criticised the visit of some French parliamentarians to Crimea. So his fear that might be, I suppose, that Crimea's sovereignty will be recognised by France and by other countries. And then that, in fact, makes it much more difficult for Ukraine to join the EU.
Yes, I think that French visit was very interesting because while it's been condemned by the government in Paris, I think it can be seen in a way as a little advance guard, just testing the water to see how much protest there would be as the possibility of sort of unfreezing freezing the whole diplomatic situation over Crimea.
How likely is that, do you think?
I think it's going to take a long time, and there's going to be a lot of rhetoric from the rest of the European Union, including Britain, who's going to say that Russia's illegal annexation of Crimea cannot possibly be recognised. But I think de facto, almost from day one, it's not been recognised diplomatically, but as a fact on the ground, it has been recognised.
So finally, Mary, what happens next with Ukraine and the EU? Where are they headed?
Well, I think there's going to be huge disillusionment, because when you contrast the scenes 2 years ago in Kiev and everybody waving European flags, huge enthusiasm, I think there was a feeling then that Ukraine deserved to be fast-tracked into the European Union simply because it felt European and it felt it deserved that because of what it had been through with its revolution. And I think that is already fading, and in the next few months, next couple of years, it risks turning into bitterness because they're not going to get the response from the European Union that they hoped for.
Mary Dzhevsky from The Independent here in the UK, talking to Georgina Godwin on The Globalist on Tuesday. This is The Recap on Monocle 24. Now, on Tuesday, Barack Obama was in Addis Ababa, where he gave a speech to the African Union. His words to the 54-nation body drove home his key points: cut corruption, respect democratic rules, stick to term limits. Commentators described it as a speech coming from a man with nothing to lose. Some reacted with enthusiasm for a speech they thought Africa had to hear, but others said it was patronising. On Tuesday's episode of The Monocle Daily, Emma Nelson and Andrew Muller heard the views of James Schneider, senior correspondent at New African Magazine, and the historian and author James D. Boyes.
I don't think his audience is really his sort of fellow presidents. I think it is more directed towards African civil society, to emerging young leaders, to put pressure on those presidents. I mean, I don't really think that most African presidents are going to be particularly sort of shamed by some guy coming and crossing the ocean and coming to give a speech in their building, not his building. But I think it will have had some effect. But more importantly, I think, or somewhere where it had more effect, he spoke in his speech, he was directly critical of his host, Ethiopia, in one way. He said, of course, amazing things have happened, you're doing wonderful things, I think he said, that was his phrase. But he said, you need to get an opposition and you can't lock up journalists. And he said that he'd raised that directly with the Prime Minister, who was the only head of government or head of state who was in the hall during the speech. And he said that Haile Mariam Desalegn, the Prime Minister, had accepted that there was a problem here. And I think those direct engagements with leaders that America has strong relationship with on other issues can bring it forward.
The speech and his visit to Africa has thrown his own record on Africa into focus. So he's made precisely half the number of trips to sub-Saharan Africa that George W. Bush did. Just as domestically, he's been in that slightly strange position of not wanting to appear too much like a black president. Is he also been in the position from a foreign policy point of view of wanting to appear not too much like he's overly interested in Africa?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, this idea, I think, that what you see with Barack Obama is someone who has campaigned very much successfully, it must be said, to achieve office as the first African-American president, but not wanting to be perceived in that respect. I think what you're going to see is, after he leaves office, I would be very surprised if he doesn't engage very much in this sphere and take a leaf out of what Bill Clinton has done and Jimmy Carter has done as well, and be a real advocate for these sorts of issues. That, I think, is far more likely. And I think that if you think about what the president said on this trip, it would have had a great deal more impetus, and the leaders that James rightly talks about maybe ignoring this issue might have been less inclined to be able to do so if this had been a speech given at the beginning of a presidency and not at the end of a presidency. You know, you think about what George W. Bush did during his time in office, someone who is universally and widely derided, but in Africa, a very, very different story with George W. Bush's legacy. This is a president seen very much as a hero there, giving $15 billion to fight AIDS and poverty across the continent. For all of the great rhetoric that Barack Obama has rightly delivered today and the great symbolic importance of a son of Africa becoming president, I think when you look at the tangible impacts that this administration will have on Africa, it'll be negligible compared to that of the preceding George W. Bush administration.
Would you agree with that, James?
It depends how well this Power Africa project develops, and at the moment it's unclear how well that's going to turn out. So the hope is that lots of investment is going to get corralled into the power sector, which takes a lot more time, and it happened quite late in Obama's presidency if you compare that to PEPFAR with George Bush, which happened relatively early on in his presidency, so you can see the benefits early on. I think it is true that what James was just saying is correct. Obama has stayed rather away from Africa, at least publicly, and Bush did have these notable engagements, but Obama is significantly more popular across the continent than Bush. Bush wouldn't have been able to make this speech. And I think also the approach that Obama has been stressing about Africa has to be dealt with on equal terms, that there's this remarkable transformations that are taking place. And he also was somewhat self-critical of the US as well, that relationship being more of equals than up to down has quite a large effect on how Africa perceives the US.
That was a highlight from Tuesday's episode of The Monocle Daily, where Emma Nelson and Andrew Muller heard from James Schneider of New African Magazine and the historian and author James D. Boyce. Up next, we're heading to Disneyland. You're listening to The Recap, a look back at our coverage of the week gone by in live news shows hosted here at Monocle 24. I'm Ben Rylan. This week we heard that Disneyland Paris is under investigation for apparently overcharging foreigners. The European Commission has prompted France to start looking into the prices at the theme park after receiving complaints of overcharging based on where people live. Well, on Midori House on Wednesday, Monocle's editor Andrew Tuck heard the thoughts of Kathleen Burke, a professor of history at University College London, and Martin Plowd, who's a fellow at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies.
I'm right behind Mickey Mouse. Not that I have ever been, let me be honest about this. But I am absolutely behind Mr. Mouse. All that is happening here is the basic logic of economics, which is price discrimination. Anyone who's ever done any economics knows about price discrimination. You charge the market with what it bears. So, for example, I now, lucky enough to carry a pensioner's pass, I get a reduced rate into a cinema. And I would defy anybody here, in fact, any of you, to say that you wouldn't take a cheap seat if you could. Now, why do they give it to me? Because I can afford less. Well, at least they think I can. So, and the same.
I was going to say, I'll have a word. I don't think our fees are that bad. But.
So the same is true with the Germans, the French. All Disney is doing is standard issue economics. They're just charging the market what it'll bear.
If the Germans got charged 80% more and the British 40% more, we have a new economic index in the making, don't we?
Absolutely.
The Disney index. That depend on how rich you as a country are, on that depends your discount. In which case, that's probably just as good as anything else.
Absolutely.
Well, I think there's another magazine, it's called The Economist or something. They have a little chart which they run every now and then. It's the hamburger index. It's
That's
what people
right.
are charged. Yeah. So although it's not within the same nation what different people are charged, they look at the fact that what you pay for a hamburger is not the same if you go downtown in Athens, if you go downtown in Amsterdam. There are different prices. Again,
but
it's all supposedly within
the same is true.
Euro.
You go to India and buy a premium quality razor blade and see what you charge. And you go to New York and see what you charge. They're completely different prices for these things. People put out the market what it will bear. I don't care. If people don't want to go to Disney, don't go. Guess what? The price will fall.
Egypt is a good example. If you go to a museum in Cairo, they have a local rate. If you're Cairene, you'll pay the equivalent like 10 pence. And if you're from the West, you'll pay the equivalent of £10. So they think actually overseas people, you can cough up a bit more. And I think actually here in the UK, there's been a bit of discussion lately that actually the cuts, austerity mean that lots of local museums are going to have to start charging for
They've
entry.
Started.
There the discussion is, you know, do we let people who can prove they're locals come in for free? But start charging those kind of pesky foreigners who are coming to our towns. Do you think that's fair enough, Kathleen?
Well, what's wholly unusual in Britain is that they don't cost anything yet. Any overseas person coming and be charged £2 is going to think they have a deal anyhow. I will be sorry to see museums charge for anyone, but particularly for local. What would you have to do? Would you have to flash your passport to show that, sort of justify what cost you were going to get? people on the one hand would think it's unfair. On the other hand, people would think, right, let's get what we can out of the foreigners.
Well, it happens with every taxi, I think, in every country outside of Europe. You'll certainly be kind of ranked on how much you charge. But on that question of cultural institutions around the world, do you think they have the right to charge wealthier visitors from developed countries and let people who live locally pay less?
I think it's a fairly standard way of doing things. It doesn't bother me in the slightest. I must say, it is always surprising. I always forget that one has to pay for a museum when I go to Berlin or Paris. I'm always rather shocked by how much I have to pay. It sort of comes as a surprise that you have to go into these things. I don't mind. It's fine. You know, one can, after all, you've paid a lot of money to get there anyway. Who cares about a few bob? And the museums certainly need it, so I'm not opposed to it. I'm in favour of Mr. Mouse and his associates.
Unless they're so young and poor that they wouldn't go in otherwise.
True.
That's okay. Where I draw the line.
That was Kathleen Burke, a professor of history at University College London, and Martin Plowd, a fellow at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies, talking to Monocle editor Andrew Tuck on Wednesday's episode of Midori House. This is The Recap on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Rylan. Now to a highlight from Thursday's episode of The Globalist, which we started by looking to Asia, where the Turkish president has been busy leading a delegation for discussions on strengthening economic ties. Midweek, we saw President Erdogan hold talks with his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping. But whilst economic ties are clearly important to the two states, there was speculation that Erdogan was also discussing plans to purchase a long-range missile system. On Thursday's episode of The Globalist, Georgina Godwin wondered how much focus would be placed on Turkey's defence during Erdogan's Asian tour. She was joined by Robert Fox, defence editor at the Evening Standard here in London.
Actually, I don't think it went terribly well because I think most of the serious NATO allies were sceptical about whether Mr. Erdogan wanted their help to fight ISIS, ISIL, to build this buffer zone, or to fight the PKK and its very active affiliates, the YDG youth movement of the PKK itself and the YPG, which is the Democratic Union Party, which the Turks are beginning to see almost in the same light as the PKK. But they've been incredibly effective. They were responsible for a very stout defence of Kobani, and they've been kicking the Syrians around in Tal Abyad. So you've got this thing, who is my enemy, who is my friend? And this is where, with his various regional ambitions, Mr. Erdogan is quite out on a limb at the moment. Funnily enough, I don't think the Chinese will want to help him over much.
Well, because I wonder about that. Turkey's involvement with the war on ISIL-IS, its closer ties with America over that, of course, that must surely change the dynamic of its relationship with China.
It does a bit, but I say that with some hesitancy, because obviously China and Russia don't particularly like Turkey's designation. It was in NATO from the beginning, from the 50s, as a forward listening post in the Cold War. It is always suspected of being the same. And you have to think, in this terribly volatile mosaic — when a mosaic is volatile, it's a kaleidoscope, isn't it — in the whole region, China looks out for the interests, and this particularly with regarding military hardware, to another ally, which is Iran. And I think China will be at least as much hanging out for Iran as it will be for Turkey and Ankara and Mr. Erdogan, just to add to complexity. Now, Erdogan is very odd too about Assad of Syria, who is being almost bolstered and propped up in some respects by Hezbollah. The thing that you hear in UK and US legislature and in comment, which is crass, my enemy's enemy is my friend today, actually doesn't work. And if you want a wonderful, elegant proof of why it doesn't work, it's because of the total ambivalence of Turkey's position today. And that is what is being exhibited over this deal with China. Do they want the Chinese missiles? Erdogan says it's a very good deal. It means opening up to China. But that's where he will seriously offend the Americans. He offends the Americans and the Brits and the French at a very practical level, because you can't integrate this stuff with half the stuff that he's got anyway from NATO. He is increasingly being regarded by the alliance, by the Western alliance, as a problem as much as an ally.
That was Robert Fox there, defence editor for the Evening Standard here in London, talking to Georgina Godwin on Thursday's edition of The Globalist.
You're listening to The Recap with me, Ben Rylan. Well, we're approaching the end of today's show, but before we go, time to hear a final highlight, this time from Friday's edition of The Globalist. After the downfall of FIFA's disgraced president Sepp Blatter, there's a vacancy for international football's top spot. A new candidate stepped forward this week, but as Monocle's Steve Bloomfield argued in his monologue on Friday, he's the wrong man for the job.
All hail the saviour of world football, the knight in shining armour to lead us out of the dark, allegedly, corruption-fuelled era of Sepp Blatter. A saviour has risen, promising a new dawn. Michel Platini, one of the greatest footballers of his generation, the silky smooth number 10 who could thread a pass through the eye of the needle, has humbly put his name forward to be the new president of FIFA. No longer will World Cups end up in tiny oil-rich desert kingdoms. No longer will a culture of corruption be indulged. No longer will family members of the FIFA president undeservedly land cushy jobs. You can see where this is going. The charge sheet against Platini is arguably longer than the one currently lying at Blatter's door. This is the man who voted for Qatar as part of what the Financial Times claims was part of a cosy relationship between France and the Gulf state. This is the man who, as president of UEFA, European football's governing body, blocked moves to create an independent ethics committee to scrutinise his executive's behaviour. This is the man whose son, Laurent, now works for a company owned by Qatar Sports Investments. And this is the man who spent 4 years as Blatter's advisor and who supported him throughout his presidency, only turning against his old boss at the last minute following the dramatic dawn arrests of 9 current or former senior FIFA executives on the eve of this year's FIFA Congress. If football wants to clean up its act, this is not the man for the job. And if football wants to remain a truly global game, Platini is not the man for the job either. In the last 3 decades, football has expanded far beyond its old European and Latin American heartlands. But Platini is old school. He believes that European nations are more important than those in Africa and Asia. While a Platini presidency threatens to do nothing to change world football's culture of corruption, it could lead to a shrinking of its reach. You would think that such a desultory dismissal of half the voters would cause Platini some damage, but he is helped by the paucity of half-decent challengers. Prince Ali bin al-Hussein of Jordan, the charisma-free anti-Blatter candidate in this year's election, is likely to run again, but most of his supporters last time only backed him because of who he wasn't. South Korea's Chung Myung-jun will have Asian support, but none from elsewhere. A handful of famous ex-footballers, Zico, Diego Maradona, David Ginola, may also throw their hat in the ring. But none have experience, nor a network of support. So it will be Platini, and a vague nod will be made in the direction of openness, and there might be another investigation into the Qatar decision. But nothing much will change. Despite the arrests and the never-ending stream of scandals, FIFA will probably carry on as before. There'll just be a different, overweight, slightly balding French speaker in charge. For Monocle, I'm Steve Bloomfield.
Well, that's all we've got time for in this week's episode of The Recap. The show was produced by Alice Block and edited by Sam Impey. Join us again next week to hear some of the very best of our live news programs here on Monocle 24. But for now, from me, Ben Rylan, thank you for listening. Goodbye.